All right, let's shift gears here and let's go to courtroom strategy and procedure. You know, 90% of the trial lawyers of America are incompetent. How do I know that? Because our Chief Justice, Warren E. Burger, back in 1978, speaking in Las Vegas, Nevada, to the National Association, or the National Bar Association, said 90% of the trial lawyers are incompetent. You know, if I could train you to be competent, you would be superior to 90% of the trial lawyers in America. There are 188 rules of evidence, 91 elements to code pleading, 47 extraordinary remedies, and 42 objections. Well, Judge Wenke made an observation. He said that in his 21 years on the bench, he met five trial lawyers who knew all 42 objections. That's like an NFL referee who knows, that would be like having a referee in Super Bowl who maybe knows half of the rules of football. Or worse yet, let's suppose there were five referees in the NFL who knew all of the rules of football. Come on, guys. Now, when you go into court, you are terrified. Everybody is. And why is that? Because it's Mystery Babylon the Great. Nobody understands what's going on in there. The only guys that really know or are supposed to know are the judge and the lawyers. And you go in there, it's like going to Catholic church. You know, you walk in and all these people are in there and some guy's speaking in a foreign language. And these people are jumping up, sitting down, kneeling, and jumping up, sitting down, and kneeling. And everybody seems to know what to do and when to do it except you. You haven't got a clue as to what's going on. Well, that's the way court is. And it's a religious operation. That priest up there wearing that long robe, sitting on the bench, who is doing the ministrations of the church, the state religion. Nobody understands it. Everybody's terrified of it. We don't get caught up in it very often. When we do, we want to plead guilty, pay the fine, and get the hell out of there just as soon as we can. And 94% of the people who go into court and plead not guilty with a lawyer and defend their case lose. Now get that one again. Sharpen your pencil on both ends. Mark this down. 94% of the people who go into court with a lawyer, paid professional advice, plead not guilty with a lawyer, 94% lose, 6% win. Well, my observation was years ago that if you knew absolutely nothing, and walked into court, pled not guilty, defended yourself by getting on the witness stand and telling your story, you could improve your chances of winning from 6% to 16%. Those are the statistics. You don't have to hire a lawyer to lose. I did that. I hired an attorney, paid him $6,000 a year for 6 years, $36,000, did three cases, paid him $5,000 up front for the three cases. Now we're over $50,000, went into court and lost three cases. Woke up one day and I said, you know, I could go into court without a lawyer and lose free. Yeah, it doesn't cost anything to go into court and lose unless you hire a lawyer. Then it costs you a whole bunch to go into court and lose 94% of the time. Now, if you're a good, competent, trained pro se litigant, I mean, you know how to go into court and make your pleadings, get on the witness stand and tell your story, examine witnesses, cross-examine witnesses, and present your evidence, you'll win 86% of the time and lose 14%. Not quite as good as the prosecutors who win 94% and lose 6%. We will win 86% and lose 14%. Now, you could go into court and do that, couldn't you? Now, what does a good lawyer look like? Because that's the first thing that your friends tell you. Whenever you get into legal trouble, they'll say to you without fail, Bob, what you need is a good lawyer. You need a good lawyer. What does a bad lawyer look like? What does a mediocre lawyer look like? Where do you find these good lawyers and mediocre lawyers? Well, looking at Corpus Juris Secundum, this is called CJS, Legal Encyclopedia. I'm in Volume 7, Section 4, the attorney-client relationship. Listen to what a lawyer's duty is. His first duty, that is the lawyer of a duty, his first duty is to the courts and the public, not to his client. Let me repeat that. The attorney that you just hired, paid him $5,000 cash up front, has three duties. The first is to the court, second is to the public, and the third is to you. His first duty is to the courts and the public, not to you, the client. And whenever his duties to his client conflict with those that he owes as an officer of the court in the administration of justice, the former must yield to the latter. So if the lawyer has to choose between the judge and you, you lose, the judge wins. If the lawyer has to decide between you and the public wins and you lose. I once talked to a public defender. His name was Larry. Larry, the public defender, had been a public defender for 6 years in Richmond, California. I asked him how many cases had he won for his clients, and he looked at me like I was Mork from Ork, and he said, "It's not the duty or the job or the responsibility of a public defender to win his client's case." I was kind of surprised. I thought lawyers were there to win your case, whether he's a public defender, working pro bono, or working for a fee. And I said, "Well, gee, what is the public defender's job, Larry?" And he said, "The public defender's job is to protect his client's rights at every stage of the proceeding." Now, for you lay people, maybe you don't understand what that means in lay language. It means my job as a public defender is to protect your rights at every stage of the proceeding. If I succeed in my goal, I will eliminate every appealable error so that when you're convicted, there will be nothing for you to appeal on. It's my job as a public defender is to make sure that when the government convicts you, that conviction cannot be overturned. And that's why you have all these people on death row, many of them innocent, as you saw up in Illinois. And even though they're innocent, they cannot be relieved or they can't be reviewed. They can't have their cases reviewed or be released because there's no appealable error. Now, isn't that just special? Here's a second little thingy over here that you ought to know about your attorney. And that is a client, that's you, the client, is one who applies to a lawyer or a counselor for advice and direction in a question of law. So you don't know the law, so you go to a lawyer, and you pay him money, and he gives you advice and direction. Or you commit your cause to his management in prosecuting a claim, that's when you're the plaintiff, or defending against a suit in court, that's when you're the defendant. One who retains the attorney is responsible to him for his fees, so you have to pay this lawyer, and to whom the lawyer is responsible for the management of the suit. So the lawyer then is responsible to manage your suit for you. That's what you're paying him for. The person who communicates facts to an attorney expecting professional advice is called a client. Clients are also called wards of the court in regard to their relationship with their attorneys. So you create what's known as a guardian-ward relationship. You give your attorney your power of attorney. That's what that means, power of attorney. You're going to give your power of attorney to your lawyer. He walks in and he defends you. If he loses, you have no right to complain because, after all, that was your guardian. Just like your daddy. Your daddy gets you your vaccinations. From your vaccinations, you have side effects. It's your daddy's responsibility, not the doctor, the hospital, or the pharmaceutical company, because after all, he's your guardian. He decided that that was good for you to have those vaccinations. Listen to James Nielsen. He's a law professor at the Hastings Law School. And he's being used as an example by Jerry Spence in his book, With Justice for None. And here's Jerry Spence. He comes in and he says this. He says, "I have taught young trial lawyers from across the land for many years in various trial seminars. And to my dismay, I find that most do not know how to conduct the simplest cross-examination or how to get an exhibit into evidence or to impeach a witness with a prior inconsistent statement." Jerry Spence makes $10 million a year as a lawyer. He's one of the 10% of the competent lawyers in America. From time to time, he holds trial seminars, and he instructs those incompetent 90% lawyers. And when he goes in there, he says, I've taught these young trial lawyers from across the land for many years in various trial seminars, and to my dismay, I find that most is 51%, most, over half, lack certain skills such as cross-examination or how to get an exhibit into evidence or to impeach a witness for a prior inconsistent statements. He says, these kinds of skills for an attorney are skills equivalent to a doctor being able to take a patient's blood pressure, examine his tonsils. Oh, wait a minute. Yet these lawyers, without the most rudimentary tools, are thrown into every kind of trial, from wrongful death suits for widows and children to the defense of capital murder cases for the accused. Then he goes on to cite James Nielsen, a professor at the Hastings Law School. He said, it is a fact that a student can graduate from this, the fourth largest law school in the United States, without ever having written a pleading, a contract, a will, a promissory note, or a deed. It's worse than that. How could it be worse than that? It's a fact, he says, that most students graduate from this, the fourth largest law school in the United States, without ever having seen a real honest-to-God pleading, contract, will, promissory note, or a deed. Now, how in hell can you graduate from law school without ever having seen a will, promissory note, contract, or a deed? And a student, he goes on to say, can graduate without ever having set foot in a courtroom, without ever having spoken to or on behalf of a person in need of advice or counsel. A student can graduate without once being exposed to the operation of the rules of court. And he says, whatever else may be said about this license issued by the state bar, licensed lawyer issued by the state bar, let it be said that for these students and their clients, it is a cruel hoax, fraud, joke. Now, here at the law school, I have a different mission in life. Number one, I'm not trying to educate educated fools. So, we don't take lawyers here. Lawyers don't come to law school here. Lawyers go to law school in law schools where they can get licensed, bonded, and insured. Now, I'm a lawyer. I'm just not licensed, bonded, or insured. I can go into court and represent myself all day long. I just can't go into court and represent you. So you can't hire me to represent you in court in your controversy. You can hire me to teach you the law so that you can go into court and represent yourself pro se. I'm also a plumber. I'm not licensed, bonded, or insured. I can't come out and fix your pipes. But you can come here to my plumbing school, and I can teach you plumbing. And then you can go down and get your own homeowner's permit and fix all the pipes in your house. Free. You don't have to pay a plumber. It's what we call do-it-yourself. Americans have been doing it themselves for many, many decades now. If you want to get the job done right, do it yourself. That's all. Do it yourself. Now, I told you that I hired an attorney and paid him some money, went in and did some cases for me. He was a very good lawyer. He was in the real estate end of law. Lawyers specialize in law like doctors specialize in medicine. And no doubt he was a wonderful real estate attorney. Never had a complaint about him in his real estate function, but when he went into court to do a litigation, that is where he had to examine, cross-examine, make objections, and do a case, he wasn't very good. Of course, I didn't know in those days that some lawyers don't practice law in court. They practice law in their offices, writing contracts and doing those kinds of ministerial duties that make them a lot of money, but they never go into court to defend anybody. But, of course, they're licensed to go into court and defend, and so I went in as a plaintiff. And this guy, well, I went in as a plaintiff once, and he lost, and then I went in as a defendant twice, and he lost. So I had a good round of experience, and here's what I discovered. I discovered that after having paid the guy $50,000 over a period of 6 years, we did three litigations, and he lost three out of three. My common sense said to me, I could probably come in here and lose free. I couldn't do any worse, and I doubt if this guy can do any better. And meanwhile, I am paying to train him so that he can come into court and practice. People practice law. Did you ever notice that? They practice. Listen, when you hire a carpenter, a plumber, or an electrician, you don't expect this guy to come out and practice on your electric box or on your pipes. You expect him to know what he's doing and come out and fix them, or to at least tell you it's not fixable, you need a new one. Now, here's a little illustration. You know, lawyers are entrepreneurs. Lawyers are in the business of making money. So Bob Jones University, some years back, they had a little problem. They needed to take it in, and they had lost at the district court level. They lost at the appellate court level, and now the only hope they had left was to go to the United States Supreme Court. So they went into this prestigious law firm in Washington, D.C., and they said, hey, would you represent us in the U.S. Supreme Court? And this prestigious law firm said, for $236,000, we'll stand on our head in the corner and whistle Dixie through a straw hat. So they paid $236,000 to go into the Supreme Court on a discrimination case. Now, anybody who'd been to law school could have researched this out and told the people at Bob Jones, you can't win this case. This is already well settled in law. You're guilty. You broke the law. You're going to have to pay the piper. But the law firm didn't tell them that. The law firm instead said, oh, God bless you, because you are standing up for the Constitution, the First Amendment, and we will work our hearts out for you. And they probably did, on a losing case. Took it to the Supreme Court, and indeed they did lose. That law firm knew or should have known that Bob Jones could not win. But if they'd have said, look, we've looked at your case and all of the transcripts, and we can tell you with certainty that if you go to the Supreme Court, you will lose again. So there's no need for you to spend $236,000 with our law firm to take up our time, effort, and energy, and to waste your money going into the Supreme Court to argue a case that can't be won. Law firms make money representing people, and remember, half the people lose and half the people win, and the lawyers win on either side. Just like a stockbroker, he doesn't care whether you're buying or whether you're selling. He makes money every time you trade. So let's understand that lawyers are entrepreneurs and lawyers are liars. And a lawyer will never tell you that you have a losing case any more than a stockbroker will tell you don't buy that stock because it's a loser. That stockbroker is in the business of selling stock. So if you've got the stock, he's going to tell you, sell it so I can make a commission. And if you don't have the stock, he's going to tell you to buy it because he's going to make a commission. He is never going to tell you the truth. And that's why lawyers are reported to be liars. That is, people instinctively know lawyers cannot be trusted. Now, let me tell you a little story here about pleadings. You know, the most important element in the case is this thing called pleadings. You go into court, you know that you're going to plead guilty or not guilty. Nobody tells you, including the judge, that you could also stand mute, plead nolo contendere, plead double jeopardy, make a plea in abatement, or plead non-assumpsit by way of confession and avoidance. Nobody tells you that. Nobody tells you, for instance, that there's a general demur and a special demur, and that instead of pleading, you could demur, and a demur, in effect, is an answer to the complaint. Nobody tells you to answer the complaint and to set up your own defense. Why is that? Well, because there's a thing here called the major and minor premise. Now, the minor premise is this. The prosecutor comes in and he says, you haven't paid your child support. You haven't paid your taxes. And you come in and you plead not guilty and reduce the controversy to a single clear-cut issue of law or fact. If it's an issue of fact, the jury can hear it. And if it's an issue of law, the jury can't hear the issue of law. Only the judge can. And, of course, nobody explained that to you either. And you could have learned all this in the 9th and 10th grades in high school, but nobody taught it to you. I have people tell me, well, Mr. Gordon, you're pretty smart, you know. You can go into court and you can do all this, and that's because you're real smart, you know. Oh, no. I'm not real smart. I'm a high school dropout. I've done 62 cases, and I've won 54. Now, I lost 8. You can't win them all. but my win-loss percentage is around 86%. My wife now has done 17 cases over the last 19 years, and she's won 17 out of 17. She had a little better advice than I had when I did my 62. And I do cases every now and again yet, to this day. And our win-loss percentage is about the same. And I can tell you in plain language, like I did the guy who came to me, he was a polygamist, down in Murray, Utah, and he said, I've got three wives, or at least this was the guy that was representing the committee, his defense committee, that were raising money from the public at large. That's all the polygamists. And said, well, we would like to take this case all the way to the United States Supreme Court. What do you think? And so I researched it out, and I came back, and I said, well, I got some good news, and I got some bad news. Let me ask you a couple of questions here. And he said, well, go ahead. And I said, well, is this Murray, Utah policeman married with a marriage license? And he said, oh, yes, yes. He's legal and lawful and bona fide and licensed and insured and has three marriage licenses with his three wives. I said, okay. I said, if by chance, could any of these three women be related, such as sisters? And he said, oh, yeah, two of them are sisters. And I said, okay. Well, in that case, then, we don't need to go any further. I don't need to waste your time. You don't need to waste mine. You cannot win this case. You are going down in flames. You're in violation of both the civil law and the common law. You do not have a religious free exercise argument to make because you've got licenses, number one, and you're in violation of the biblical prohibition against marrying sisters. And this has already been adjudicated in Reynolds versus U.S., and because of that, you're going down in flames and you're going to lose. Now, the law does not prohibit polygamy. I want to emphasize that. In the United States of America, there's no law against polygamy. There is a law against practicing plural marriages with a marriage license, but there's no law against having two wives, six wives, or nine wives with no marriage license. So for all of you Mormon polygamists out there, if you have a marriage license with one or more of your plural wives, you're in violation of the law. You're in violation of the law of God because you got a marriage license, and you're in violation of the state because you have a contract and you're in breach of contract. It's just that simple. That's what I told the man. And he was sad, and he went away sad, and they went ahead and hired a law firm, and they took the case to the U.S. Supreme Court, and that case, along with the Reynolds case, demonstrates just exactly what I told you, and that is, he lost. Difference is, I didn't take his money for no good purpose, but the law firm that represented him also knew they were going to lose. But they told him, you just pay your money and come on in here, son, and we'll just argue and we'll just plead and jump up and down, paw the ground, bite the bushes, and do all those things that lawyers are supposed to do to make you feel real good about us. And we'll do everything we can to win, knowing full well that they were going to lose. Now, let me show you a little something here from Chapter 19, Koffler Reppe, on considerations preliminary to the classification of defenses. Let me tell you a little story. Let's suppose an MP comes in here and he says to me, George Gordon, you're under arrest for being absent without leave from Fort Lewis, Washington. And I say, well, it's true, my name is George Gordon. And now that you're going to arrest me, are you going to take me to the grand jury in Springfield? Are you going to take me up for a preliminary hearing? Are you going to take me in for an arraignment? No, 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 none of the above. I'm going to go right straight to the brig in Fort Lewis, Washington. Am I going to get due process and equal protection under the Constitution and the Bill of Rights? No, no, no. I'm going to be prosecuted under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, the UCMJ. But you say, well, wait a minute, that violates your constitutional rights. No, 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 it doesn't violate my constitutional rights. And if I want to assert my constitutional rights, then I'm going to have to be smart enough to come into this military court and defend. If I'm going to be smart enough to come into this patent court, then I'm going to have to be smart enough to defend. You have to know the rules of court. So I come up before the provost marshal, and he says, now, Sergeant Gordon, you've been charged with a violation of 2204 of the Uniform Code of Military Justice in that you're absent without leave from Fort Lewis, Washington. How do you plead to that charge? And the minute I plead not guilty from that moment on, I cannot win. and neither can you. And when you walk into court and the judge says, how do you plead today, guilty or not guilty? If you plead guilty, you cannot win. If you plead not guilty, you cannot win. If you plead nolo contendere, you cannot win. All right, now you understand that? So when a judge is asking you the question, how do you plead to this charge, he's asking you, do you want the red death pill or the green death pill? It's up to you to be smart enough to say, well, I think I'll pass on both the red and the death green pills. I think I'll take the white life pill, and I think I will answer the complaint with a general demur. And if the judge says, my God, demurs are abolished in federal practice. Okay, but a motion to dismiss for failure of the state to prove its prima facie case isn't. And that's all that has been changed here from a general demur to a motion to dismiss under Rule 56, 12b6, or a motion to dismiss for failure of the state to prove its prima facie case. The names have changed, but the procedures are identical. Now, of course, nobody's explaining that to you now in the 9th and 10th grades, but let me explain it to you. You see, when the prosecutor comes in, he writes up a complaint which contains what's called the minor premise. And that's because if it's assumed that every liability consists of two elements, called a given combination of facts or events plus a rule of substantive law attaching legal consequences to those facts or events, and if it be remembered that in order to state a good cause of action, one need only set out the combination of facts. One need only set out the combination of facts. One need only set out the combination of facts and events. That's all the prosecutor does. He doesn't sit there and explain how you're in violation of the law. He just sets out the combination of facts and events. The court then takes judicial notice of the rule of law without its statement, and the question arises, in how many ways may the defendant resist the alleged liability asserted in the declaration? And the answer is two. Two. You get two things you're going to do. You're going to plead or demur. That's it. If you plead, you're only going to plead guilty or not guilty, because the judge is never going to tell you that you have the right to stand mute, plead nolo contendere, plead double jeopardy, plea an abatement, or a plea of non-assumpsit by way of confession and avoidance. He's just like a carpet salesman. You know, the carpet salesman asks you, do you want the high-low carpet or the shag? He asks you, do you want the green carpet or the red carpet? Do you want to pay with cash or check? You know, he doesn't ask you what you want. He gives you an alternative to choose from. Either alternative, he wins and you lose. And besides that, the judge is working for the state. So pay attention now, boys and girls. When you walk into court and you're looking for a fair trial, fair trial, fair trial, you're not going to get it in court. Not unless you know how to create a fair trial. Let's try this one on for size. You walk into court and you've got a complaint, and the complaint says that you haven't paid your child support, and the complaint says the state of California versus Joe Sixpack. Who is the complaining party? It's the state of California. The state of California is complaining about your behavior or your failure to behave properly. And the state then brings you into state court. This is called a superior court in California, and you go before a state trial judge. This state trial judge is being paid every Friday by who? Who pays the judge's salary? Who's paying the judge's salary? It's the state of California. The state of California is complaining about your behavior. And then the state of California takes you in to the court of the state of California. So the state of California takes you into the state court in front of the state judge who's being paid on Friday by the state of California, the party who's complaining about your behavior. Now there's another guy in there called a prosecutor. This prosecutor is prosecuting you, and the prosecutor says, I'm here to put you away for the full term. You're a criminal, and I'm going to lay you away. Who's paying his salary? Ah, the complaining witness, the state of California, the state of California. Ah, and now we need a witness against you. Who is this witness against you? It's the policeman, the IRS agent. It's the employee of who? The state of California. Now the judge looks at you and says, Joe, maybe you don't understand the proceedings that are going on here. Maybe you're confused. And we just want to help. We just want to protect and serve. And so, at no cost to you whatsoever, we're going to appoint the public defender. Yes, sir. We're going to give you the public defender who's going to come in at no cost to you, which is a lie. And the public defender is being paid by who? Yeah, that's right. The state of California. Now, here you got the state of California brings you into the state's court in front of the state's judge, being prosecuted by the state's prosecutor. The witnesses against you are state agents who are being paid by the state, and then your defense lawyer is licensed by the state or is working and being paid by the state. And this is called a fair trial. Come on, Joe. Come on, Joe. If you're not brain dead, pay attention. This is not a fair trial, Joe. You need to get rid of that public defender. You need to come in here with some knowledge of the rules so that you can apply the rules. You know, there's seven pleas you could make. There are two demurs you could make. There's an answer to the complaint you could make. You know, Joe, if you grow up and get wise in a hurry, you could probably go in there and win 84% of the time. Now, that's the purpose for the Gordon Law School. Now, let's go back here to the soldier. Let me ask you a question. Do you think that the charge of being absent without leave from Fort Lewis, Washington, is a fair charge? Well, let me tell you, it's not only fair, it's true, accurate, and correct, because my name is George Gordon, and I am absent from Fort Lewis, and I don't have anybody's permission from Fort Lewis, Washington, to be right here today where I am. So if somebody came in here and charged me with being absent without leave from Fort Lewis, Washington, factually, that's true. Legally, that's false, because there are two defenses, the minor premise and the major premise. The minor premise is George Gordon is absent without leave from Fort Lewis, Washington, but the major premise is George Gordon doesn't have an enlistment contract with the United States Army, and this court doesn't have jurisdiction. Now, many people get mixed up over this jurisdiction thing, so let me hit it with you, or let me explain it to you just quickly. It is true that when you challenge jurisdiction, it is the burden then of the court or the prosecution to come in and prove jurisdiction. But, you know, walking into court, folding your arms, and saying, I challenge the jurisdiction of this court is not a jurisdictional challenge. Yeah, let me repeat that. Just announcing to the court that you're challenging the jurisdiction of the court is not a jurisdictional challenge, and the judge doesn't say a word. He just listens, and he's waiting for you to make the next statement. And I am prepared to offer witnesses, evidence, and testimony to prove that, and my first witness is. And then when you produce the witnesses, evidence, and testimony to prove that the court doesn't have jurisdiction, that is, that with a subpoena deuces tecum, you come in and demand that the prosecutor bring in the enlistment contract, and when he fails to do that, you move to dismiss in summary judgment because the state cannot prove their prima facie case, and that is that you're absent without leave from Fort Lewis, Washington, because the first objective has to prove that you're a soldier in the Army. And nobody has to raise the issue of whether or not you're a soldier unless you raise it in your own defense. And that's the purpose for pleadings. And if you can't get your pleadings correct, you can't win the case. All right, now there's 28 things that you have to know in courtroom strategy and procedure. I've just kind of touched the tip of the iceberg here to give you an idea of what it is you have to do, what it is you're going to have to learn. 28 things. I covered a couple of them. Now, in order for you to learn more, why don't you call us here at the law school? The number is 417-273-4967. That's area code 417-273-4967. If you're online, just go to my webpage. It's georgegordon.net, georgegordon.net, or you can hit com or org. It doesn't really make any difference. We got them all, but georgegordon.net. Click onto the email machine. That'll be my email address. Send us an email request for more information, and we'd be happy to give it to you. All right, I'm at the end of this disc. Let's change the disc over here, and we'll come back, and we'll take a look at another topic in the 8 schools here at the Gordon Law School. Maybe we'll take up private business next. That sounds like a good one. Private business. Stand by.